Hello. Welcome to Illinois Radio Reader. This is Lisa bringing you the News Gazette today, Wednesday, October 22nd, 2025. Hope you're having a great day today. On the front page today of the News Gazette is a very large close-up picture from Fisher with the heading, From Fisher to the Fall Classics. And there's a picture of a young man, Colt Doherty. It says, first impression with baseball started as a desperate attempt to stay active during the COVID-19 pandemic. He says after his first practice with his team, he regretted it immediately, and only through sticking the year out did he develop a love for the sport. And he's got his catcher's mitt close to his face, and you can see the determination in his eyes. And the article is entitled, Bunnies freshman Colt Doherty's skills have headed to sport's biggest page, by Rob Lacates. On the same field where Shohei Ohtani and Vlad Guerrero Jr. will play World Series Game 2 the night before, a 14-year-old Fisher phenom will chase some October glory of his own this weekend in Toronto. If Colt Doherty is nervous about competing on the world's biggest stage in Major League Baseball's pitch hit and runs final, he doesn't show it, Mom said. For me, it's just fun to see his eyes get all big and reach his dreams, Veronica Shoemaker said. It's fun to see his hard work pay off. Colt earned an all-expense-paid trip to the World Series for him and his coach-slash-dad, Chase Doherty, by posting the fourth-best score nationally among 13- and 14-year-olds. A competition that started with some 50,000 youth baseball and softball players in 8 classifications ended with 40 being invited to join the Dodgers and Blue Jays in Toronto this weekend. Pitching and hitting at Rogers Center shouldn't faze Colt, given where he performed to earn a spot in the finals 2 months ago, Chicago's Wrigley Field. It's just like a dream, Colt said, and it doesn't feel real. In Toronto, he and his fellow finalists will get the celebrity treatment with MLB picking up the tab. Colt and his dad will fly to Toronto on Friday morning, passports in hand, when it looked like the Blue Jays might be among the teams in position to host the World Series. MLB informed all of the finalists' families to make sure they had documents required for the international travel. On Friday night, the youths and their guardians will meet up for Game 1 watch party in Toronto. Saturday morning, they'll head to the stadium for batting practice on the Blue Jays field, followed by an excursion, then back to Rogers Center to watch Game 2 as a group. Family members who didn't make the trip were given a heads up. The plan is for Fox to show the group during its live broadcast sometime in the third or fourth inning. Sunday morning is back to the stadium for the pitch hit and fun run finals, an experience that Colt has been looking forward to for 4 years, when he first participated in the competition. Since taking up baseball at age 9, after seeing a tryout sign for a Muhammad travel team, Colt has starred on the pitcher's mound. I've always had the strongest arm on any of my teams, so I've always been the ace, he said. To help with his hitting, the family had a batting cage installed in the backyard where the Fisher High School freshman would spend hours on end after dinner. Like in football, Chase Doherty doubles as Colt's coach, and no one pushes him harder than his dad, Colt said. He's held to even a higher standard than anybody else because he's a coach's kid, Chase said. It's been his whole life. And there's another picture of Colt getting ready to throw a very strong pitch. It says, Colt Doherty takes aim with a pitch. Colt is headed for an all-expense-paid trip to World Series in Toronto for the finals of the MLB Pitch, Hit, and Run Challenge, where he is in fourth place in the 13th and 14-year-old division. Good luck to him. Continuing on the front page, an article from the Urbana City Council by Jana Wiersema with the heading, Federal Grant Agreement Passes by Narrow Margin. Aldermen concerned about language on immigration and DEI. In a narrow 3-2 vote Monday night, the City Council approved a federal grant agreement for firefighter radios that include language about immigration and diversity, equity, and inclusion that several aldermen found questionable. Alderman Mary Alice Wu Sharice Hersey and Chris Evans voted to accept an Assistance to Firefighters grant from the Federal Emergency Management Agency, while Alderman Grace Wilkin and Jaya Colsetti voted it down. The live stream of Monday night's meeting had some technical difficulties, resulting in the first about 45 minutes having no audio. Only the last 10 minutes of the discussion regarding the grant agreement can be heard on the YouTube video. I do not agree with some of the terminology that is used, Wu said after the technical issues was fixed. It's not very Urbana speak, basically. It goes against our values. But I am very confident that with the legal advice that we've been given, with the short term of this grant being very immediate, it doesn't tie our hands. Wu previously made a motion to remove the grant agreement from the October 6th Committee of the Whole agenda so officials could consult with the city attorney, Matt Rochely, who was sick at the time. According to a report by Urbana Fire Department Administrator Teresa Hoffman, the department has been awarded $867,814 with which to buy 800 megahertz portable radios. Acceptance of the grant requires a City Council resolution acknowledging the city's obligation to contribute 10% of the awarded funds, she said. This would require the city of Urbana to contribute $6,781 to the AFG award, totaling $74,596. The term of the grant include Article 11, titled Communication and Cooperation with the Department of Homeland Security and Immigration Officials, which outlines requirements such as not restricting information sharing of an individual's citizenship or immigration status, complying with prohibitions on encouraging illegal immigration and transporting, harboring, concealing, or shielding from detection illegal aliens, honoring requests for cooperation, not publicizing the existence of an immigration enforcement operation. Furthermore, Article 19 on anti-discrimination appears to forbid the city from operating diversity, equity, and inclusion initiatives. However, Article 58, non-applicability of specific agreement article states, notwithstanding their inclusion in this award package, the following agreement articles do not apply to this grant award. 1. Communication and cooperation with the Department of Homeland Security and Immigration Officials. 2. Paragraph 2A3 of anti-discrimination. That paragraph forbids grant recipients from operating any program that benefits illegal immigrants or incentivizes illegal immigration. Rochely said Article 58 explicitly cancels out the earlier section on cooperating with immigration enforcement. You can kind of set aside concerns about whether or not we can comply with those things because they are explicitly not part of this grant agreement, per the agreement itself, he said. As for Article 19 on anti-discrimination, Rochely stated that while much of the language was concerning on its face to the council, his takeaway is that this section does not create new legal obligations for the city. The section states that grant recipients must not, during the term of the award, operate any programs that advance or promote DEI, DEIA, or discriminatory equity ideology in violation of federal anti-discrimination laws. Rochely said that the operative phrase is in violation of federal anti-discrimination laws. It doesn't say that the city can't promote diversity, equity, and inclusion, or anything along those lines, he said. It simply says that we can't violate federal anti-discrimination law in doing so, which, to the best of our knowledge, we do not do and will not do. He also noted that some of the terms used in that section, such as discriminatory equity ideology, stem from President Donald Trump's January 29th executive order titled Ending Racial Indoctrination in K-12 Schooling. The order defines discriminatory equity ideology as one that treats individuals as members of preferred or disfavored groups rather than as individuals and minimizes agency, merit, and capability in favor of immoral generalizations. The executive order lists a number of examples, including categorizing a person as privileged, oppressing or oppressed based on race, sex, or national origin. However, the grant agreement with FEMA does not include a legal definition rooted in federal statute for this term, Rochely said. In discussing her decision to vote no, Colasetti said, "Not all of the language that I find concerning is negated. I think that there are still things that could either tie our hands or not be in line with the Urbana values that could be related to this grant," she said. "And certainly, the consequences of having funding clawed back at this amount is not the end of the world, but I think it's just not a risk I feel comfortable taking." She later added, "While we might disagree on strategy, I have no questions in my mind that this council and this administration will consider to fight for the rights of all of our residents." Wilkin likewise said she remained concerned about the anti-discrimination section and how the federal administration's definition of discriminatory equity ideology, in her opinion, contradicts things like our resolution to have more equity throughout the city or our equity and quality of life grants, money in our budget for that, for the reparations study. "It's not worth selling our city's values and potentially having a lot of conflicting problems down the line when we could just say no in the first place," she said. Though Evans voted in favor of the agreement, he said he completely agreed with Wilkin and Colasetti. "I'm worried that I'm letting the wolf into the henhouse here, but I'm going to support this grant so that the firefighters can get the radios quicker," he said. "And I'm down for the fight if there's a clawback situation or they start whatever crazy thing happens next. If by accepting this grant they start bossing us around regarding stuff that's important to this city, you can't tell us to help ICE." Both the Immigration Project and Champaign County Board member Emily Rodriguez shared on social media that officials with Immigration and Customs Enforcement were cited in Urbana on Monday. "I can confirm that ICE was here today to target select individuals," Rodriguez wrote. "Agents were unmasked. No local law enforcement agency was informed ahead of time. And as far as I know, this is not part of a mass operation. Please continue to document any sightings you see." And there's a picture at the bottom of the front page with the title, Swimming Instructors. And there's five girls getting ready and shouting at the pool. Centennial swimmers cheer for their teammate at the annual Twin City Girls Swim and Dive Meet featuring Centennial, Champaign Central, St. Thomas More, Urbana, and Uni High on Tuesday at the Unit 4 pool in Champaign. And we'll read more about that story, hopefully later. And the last article on the front page with the title, Trial Begins for Chicago Man Accused of Arson and Stalking, from the Champaign Courts by Luke Taylor. The trial for a Chicago man charged with stalking and aggravated arson at a Champaign residence began Tuesday, with the prosecution presenting a web of witnesses related to both the defendant and the victim. Terrell V. Holt, 34, stands accused of setting a backpack on fire July 12th after allegedly threatening multiple family members he believed were keeping him apart from his partner. Public defender Elizabeth Pollock said in her opening statement that while Holt and the victim are cousins, that was not the point of the trial. "It was a consensual relationship, even if it offends you, and even if you think it's not normal, and even if you think it's wrong," Pollock said. While the charges are unrelated, the relationship was the cause for other family members and friends to be concerned. One witness described believing Holt was abusing his girlfriend because she turned up with injuries more than once. She was not present at the scene of the alleged arson incident, though. A witness who is also Holt's cousin said on the night of the arson, she walked into the kitchen of her house and looked out the back door where she saw a fire starting. "The porch light was on," she said, "and she is confident she saw Holt leaving." She said she then ran to her mother's roommate to tell her he was there and there was a fire behind the house. The mother testified as well, though Pollock suggested that parts of her story were in a different order from her daughter's. Both described seeing Holt outside the house. The mother said upon hearing about the fire that she went to the kitchen, grabbed an empty container out of the trash can, and filled it up with water, then used it to douse the fire. She said she did that twice before it went out. After that, she said she was in her room calling the police when Holt pounded on the window. Assistant State's Attorney Scott Larson presented texts and Facebook messages between the defendant and the multiple witnesses in which Holt demanded to know the location of his partner. Larson said that she returned to Champaign from Chicago, where she and Holt were living, with the intention of picking up her son. She said a family member resisted, not liking the idea of the son being around Holt, and the partner became angry, allegedly kicking in a door and punching a hole in a wall. Larson said she was arrested in relation to that incident and was in jail when Holt came down to Champaign to look for her. He allegedly called and texted multiple people close with her, demanding to see her. Larson said the woman whose house he allegedly set the fire near lied about the location of the partner, who is her daughter, in order to keep them separated. The prosecutor said text exchanges between the woman and Holt were combative, and she said he was also talking to her on the phone at some points while texting. Larson said on the day after the fire, Holt sent her a message that read, "I was watching the news the other day. It said this summer kids might want to stay in the house. The heat is hot." Larson said he also texted her about another house where he believed his partner might be, saying he had filled up his gas tank in case of a high-speed chase. "Oh, believe me, I'm not playing," the text said. The woman said she had to prioritize her daughter over her nephew, but that it upset her to see Holt doing all this. "I'm not easily moved. Terrell broke my heart," she said. Pollock, in her opening statement, suggested that the family could have been attempting to frame Holt in retaliation for this relationship that they disagreed with. Holt's trial is set to continue and will likely to conclude today. Let's switch over to an opinion piece by J. Mark Powell in his Holy Cow History. Today in his article, there's a large and pretty pastel painting of Unsinkable Sam, also known as Oscar, or Oscar, the German spelling with a K, a tuxedo cat said to have survived the sinking of a German battleship and two Royal Navy ships during World War II, painted by Georgina Shaw Baker. Unsinkable Sam, the world's luckiest cat? With a question mark. You've heard about the unsinkable Molly Brown, the brassy nouveau riche millionaire mine owner's wife who made it safely off the sinking Titanic. As incredible as that was, she has nothing on a remarkably feisty feline, because he survived not one, but three ship sinkings, and in wartime, too, no less. At least that's the story. Listen to it, and you decide for yourself. Meet Unsinkable Sam, the luckiest cat in the world. It would be all too easy to make a lame reference to a cat having nine lives. Sam must have had at least twice that many. Very little is known about his early life. He was likely born in Germany because he wound up on a German battleship in World War II. For centuries, sailors kept cats with them on the high seas, partly for the companionship and partly to go after rodent stowaways. And he wasn't just any old battleship. It wasn't just any old battleship either. It was one of the biggest, most ferocious, and potentially deadliest of all, the mighty Bismarck. It was such a grave threat that even the dauntless and determined Winston Churchill was worried about it. So when the Bismarck steamed out of port in May of 1941, the British made destroying it priority 1, 2, and 3. Bismarck quickly sank the battleship HMS Hood, causing the Brits to dispatch dozens of warships to hunt for the German ship. When it finally went to the bottom of the Atlantic on May 26, almost 2,100 crewmen went with it. British and German vessels picked up 115 survivors. Sailors on one of them, the destroyer HMS Cossack, spotted something clinging to a piece of debris floating in the water. Upon closer examination, they found it to be a tuxedo cat, black with white markings on its mouth and chest. Think of Sylvester in the old Looney Tunes cartoons. He was the only survivor the Cossack found. The cat switched sides that day, going over from the Axis to the Allies. Since the Cossack's crew didn't know his name, they called him Oscar. It's theorized that they called him that because in the International Code of Signals, O means man overboard. Although his allegiance had changed, his luck hadn't. That fall, the Cossack was torpedoed by a Nazi U-boat west of Gibraltar. It sank on October 27th, almost 5 months after the Bismarck went down. Once again, a drenched cat was seen clinging to a piece of debris and was once more hauled aboard a British warship, the HMS Ark Royal. In a neat twist of fate, that aircraft carrier had played a key role in disabling the Bismarck the previous spring. As word of the cat's repeated ability to cheat death on the high seas spread, folks stopped calling him Oscar and gave him a new name, Unsinkable Sam. The plucky feline had yet another rendezvous with fate waiting right around the corner. This time, it was the Ark Royal that was dispatched to Davy Jones' locker. Barely 2 weeks after the Cossack's loss, another U-boat torpedoed the mighty carrier, also off Gibraltar. A motor-launched pluck, a quite angry but otherwise unharmed Sam from the sea. He must have been thinking, this is really getting old. That was the end of Sam's adventures. He spent the rest of his wartime service as a mouser in the Governor's General's building in Gibraltar. He eventually wound up at a home for sailors in Belfast, Northern Ireland, peacefully passing away at a ripe old age in 1955. Historians are quick to poo-poo the story. They claim it's riddled with more factual holes than the hull of the Bismarck. Serious students of World War II lump it in the tall tales category. Yet it was so widely circulated around the British Isles during the war years that it seems something involving a cat at sea must have happened. Perhaps we'll never know. Maybe this is just one of those stories that should have been true, even if it wasn't. Let's continue on in our communities with an article from Capital Coverage from Chicago. Immigration Enforcement in Chicago by Hannah Meisel. Trump extends judge's block on deploying troops as Supreme Court weighs case. The Trump administration has agreed to extend a federal judge's temporary block on deploying National Guard troops to Chicago, while the U.S. Supreme Court weighs whether to stay the judge's order. In a filing on Tuesday, 2 days before U.S. District Judge April Perry's 14-day temporary restraining order is set to expire, Department of Justice attorneys said they'd consented to a 30-day extension of the order. The Trump administration appealed the matter to the U.S. Supreme Court late last week, and it's unclear when the High Court may rule. In its filings to the Supreme Court, U.S. Solicitor General John Sauer argued the judicial branch has no right to second-guess a president's judgment on national security matters or resulting military actions. The administration maintains that deployment of National Guard troops is necessary to protect federal immigration agents and property from protesters. A federal district court lacks not only the authority but also the competence to wrest control of the military chain of command from the commander-in-chief, Sauer wrote. Lawyer for the state of Illinois shot back in their own filing Monday, citing two U.S. Supreme Court decisions from the last century, including one invalidating presidential seizure of steel mills during the Korean War. Furthermore, federal courts are fully empowered to consider claims resulting from military intrusion into the civilian sector. Lawyers in Attorney General Kwame Raoul's office wrote, citing a 1972 decision, there are numerous indications that the questions presented here fall within his duty. President Donald Trump's October 4th order to federalize or take control of 300 members of the Illinois National Guard, along with the deployment of 200 Texas Guardsmen and another 16 troops from California, has been blocked since Perry's October 9th ruling. The judge said the Justice Department's argument of violence added to a growing body of evidence that the Department of Homeland Security's version of events are unreliable, as the administration's narrative about violent protests in Chicago differs so strongly from the accounts of state and local law enforcement. Perry also found there was no credible evidence that there is a danger of rebellion in the state of Illinois. The Seventh Circuit Court of Appeals backed up Perry's last week, with a three-judge panel writing in an opinion published Thursday that political opposition is not rebellion. The three-judge appeals panel did not stay the portion of Perry's order blocking the administration from federalizing National Guard troops, but the administration accused the Seventh Circuit of judiciously micromanaging the exercise of the president's commander-in-chief powers, as the appellate judges still sided with Perry on the actual deployment of guardsmen. Continuing on this page, an article about election 2026 with the heading "Video Gambling Mogul to Seek GOP Nomination in Governor Race" by Brendan Moore. A suburban Chicago video gambling mogul is putting his chips into a Republican primary bid for Illinois governor. Rick Heidner of Barrington Hills, real estate developer and the owner of Gold Rush Gaming, formed a gubernatorial campaign committee Tuesday, according to a filing with the Illinois State Board of Elections. It comes less than 2 weeks before the petition filing deadline for the March primary. Candidates for governor must attain at least 5,000 signatures to secure place on the ballot. Heidner's running mate is Homer Glenn Mayor Christina Troike, according to petitions being circulated. Heidner joins a crowded Republican primary field that includes former state senator Darren Bailey, the party's 2022 gubernatorial nominee, Ted Dabrowski, former president of conservative think tank Wirepoints, and two-term DuPage County Sheriff James Mendrick. The winner likely gets a matchup against Democratic Governor J.B. Pritzker, a multi-billionaire who is seeking a third term as the state's chief executive. Calls to Heidner from Capital News Illinois were not immediately returned on Tuesday. The 65-year-old has been a player in the state's business community and political circles for decades. Gold Rush Gaming, which Heidner founded with his wife Elisa in 2012, is the third largest operator of video gambling terminals in Illinois. The company's machines are in nearly 800 bars, restaurants, and gas stations across the state, according to Illinois Gaming Board records. And Heidner's real estate firm manages more than 280 properties across the country. He also owns the gas station chain Ricky Rocket's Fuel Center and wholesale fuel supplier Prairie State Energy. Heidner has been associated with some controversial figures over the years. In 2019, the Chicago Tribune reported that he partnered in some real estate deals with a banking family that had alleged mob ties. Around the same time, Heidner's name surfaced in a federal search warrant executed on now former state senator Martin Sandoval's Springfield office as part of a sweeping public corruption probe. Federal prosecutors later confirmed that Heidner was not a target of the investigation. Amid all of that, the Pritzker administration axed the proposed sale of a state-owned site in Tinley Park, eyed by Heidner and Hawthorne Racecourse president Tim Carey, for a racetrack and casino project. Heidner and his wife were also hit with a $5 million federal tax lien in 2023, according to the Chicago Sun-Times. A spokesman for the couple told the paper at the time that the amount owed would be paid back within a few weeks under the Internal Revenue Service payment plan. Heidner has been a generous and bipartisan donor to Illinois political candidates over the years in his personal capacity and through his property management company. He was financial supporter of Aurora Mayor Richard Irvin's failed GOP gubernatorial bid in 2022, and he has contributed to prominent Democrats such as Chicago Mayor Brandon Johnson, Cook County Board President Tony Preckwinkle, and Illinois State President Don Harmon. And there's a picture of the entrance to the governor's office at the Illinois State Capitol in Springfield. And I'm going to take a break here with our first part of the News Gazette, dated Wednesday, October 22nd, and I will describe to you a picture that has been included in the paper today of a University of Illinois student, Maddie Weiss, and Jay Smith, taking a walk Tuesday under the fall colors at the Boneyard Creek 2nd Street Basin in Champaign. Beautiful picture of orange and red trees. And I'll be back shortly. Stick with it.